From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, Something Wild is celebrating its 20th birthday, 2 decades of exploring and explaining the natural world. And that provides us here in The Exchange a chance to reflect on just how much is different from 20 years ago. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. What changes have you seen in New Hampshire's great outdoors and the creatures who inhabit it? Give us your observations of animals or plants, or just the way the landscape looks to you. Send us an email. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We have 4 guests in the studio. 3 of them are Something Wild hosts, past and present. They include Rosemary Conroy, one of the first hosts of Something Wild while she was with the Forest Society. Rosemary is now a contemporary wildlife artist living in Ware. Rosemary, great to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Also with us, Dave Anderson, naturalist and director of education at the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, one of the current hosts of Something Wild. Dave, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Laura.
And another current host, Chris Martin, senior wildlife biologist with the New Hampshire Audubon, specializing in raptors. And Chris, thanks for being here.
Hi, Laura.
And joining us also is Mike Marchand, program supervisor of the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department's Non-Game and Endangered Wildlife Program. Mike is also a wildlife biologist. And Mike, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, all of you, but Dave, you first. How has the general public's interest and understanding of nature changed over the past 20 years? That's what Something Wild was sort of all about when you started it 20 years ago.
Sure. I mean, ultimately, it's an education effort. You go back to 1998, I would say that people are more discerning consumers of information. They're better informed. They have access to the internet. I don't hear some of the old myths as much as I used to about bears hooting and fishers screaming and, you know, coy dogs. I think people have seen through social media photos from their backyards. People are taking photos with their smartphones, sharing those, asking questions. And then there's wildlife cameras in the woods that have been, you know, those didn't exist 20 years ago. There's got to be tens of thousands of cameras out there. So we're actually seeing more of what's going on that we used to not be able to see.
So we're more nature literate than we used to be.
I think we are. I do.
And in a good way?
Yes, absolutely. Because how could you be nature literate in a bad way, you know? So I think it's important people are better connected, albeit via social media and screen time. So there's the other side of the coin.
Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. You may know more, but if you're not getting out experiencing it firsthand.
Is it real experience or is it book experience?
So, Rosemary, you too, given that the average Granite Stater has always been pretty connected to the outdoors, how would you answer that question? Are we more nature literate than we used to be?
Well, I mean, my social media feed is completely filled with pictures of animals and beautiful landscapes and sunrises and sunsets. So I think people, I'm not an expert anymore, I guess. So I think people still have that affinity for nature. That hasn't changed, that fundamental quality that people just love nature. And that's great.
So they love it. They have an affinity for it. Do they understand it better than they used to?
I'd have to leave that to Dave and Chris to answer.
So what do you think, Chris? I mean, you know, we're also talking at a time when people have written about nature deficit disorder, that young people don't get outside as much as we all did when we were kids, and that in general, kids and adults spend less time outside. So how does that fit into this broader idea that Dave and Rosemary raised that, you know, people are nature literate and they know what it looks like and they can look it up and understand anything at a moment's notice?
Well, the thing that occurred to me is I think people are more participatory in some ways in nature now. There's so many more ways you can volunteer to do things outdoors. It used to be there was only 1 or 2 or 3 organizations that you could volunteer for that did wildlife work or were outside. Now, every unit of the state has a land trust that's associated with it. There's this thing called Nature Groupie, where people can get an email feed saying, here's the volunteer opportunities this weekend, this month, next month, and drop in and do it, sort of like a meetup kind of thing. It's easy to get involved now, which it was harder to get involved 20 years ago, I think.
And yet New Hampshire people have always been involved, and I just wonder about that level of involvement. Is it greater? Is it the same? Is it different?
Oh, I think it's different in a lot of ways. Although having worked with volunteers for nearly 30 years now, the drive to just step up and say, I want to help with this. I'm not sure I know what to do, but I'd love to help out. That's still strong. I get calls every week from people that want to help with raptor monitoring.
As an educator, how do you feel about the term nature deficit disorder?
I think it's a little too technical.
Really?
The bottom line is get off your computer and get outside.
And are people doing it, Dave?
I think so. You know, the term citizen science comes up. A lot of conservation organizations and volunteer organizations are giving the public opportunities to get firsthand experience and actually contribute to scientific understanding, generating some data. The whole nature deficit disorder came from Richard Louv's Last Child in the Woods. I think people in New Hampshire have tremendous access to open space, something about like 33% of New Hampshire is permanently conserved. That said, in southern New Hampshire, land conversion continues and people are moving into closer proximity to forest lands and wetlands, former farmlands. And so people have the opportunity to have direct access, but are they actually participating? Are they actually getting outside?
Again, the phone number for you to join us here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, as the NHPR program Something Wild celebrates 20 years of bringing nature to NHPR listeners, we're going to take a look at how New Hampshire's approach toward wildlife management, land conservation, our general nature literacy, as our guests put it, has changed over the time this program has been on the air. Let's get your thoughts, questions, comments in. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, nhpr.org. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. And Mike Marchand, as we talk about how people understand nature, wildlife, habitat, how they engage with it, Fish and Game has a wildlife action plan to give people information about wildlife and habitat. It's pretty detailed, lots of data, lots of maps. How does this play a part in sort of educating us about nature literacy?
Yeah, so I'm lucky in that I specialize on the wildlife side of nature, and people are very passionate about wildlife. Everybody has a story to tell and relates in different ways. And so New Hampshire Fish and Game with our partners developed a wildlife action plan, which essentially lays a blueprint for wildlife conservation in the state of New Hampshire. And every state across the country has one. And it's a great way to engage citizens. They use the wildlife action plan as a science-based product to look up and provide information to their communities and their citizens. And we get questions and calls all the time about information in it.
What sorts of questions and calls do you get from people? I'm curious.
We get calls from everyone from school groups looking to do a book report on a Canada lynx to more technical questions about how do I use this information to conduct land planning in my town and protect the most important areas.
Yeah, and how do communities use that to decide where they're going to build? I mean, how much, Mike, does this plan help communities decide, oh, we should put the shopping area over here, not over here, because there's some sort of critical habitat over here?
Yeah, so the intent of the wildlife action plans is to be largely proactive and non-regulatory. However, it provides a lot of information for people to use to make those decisions. And so the piece of the wildlife action plan that people are most familiar with are the maps that we've produced. And so they identify some of the best remaining places in New Hampshire that are great for wildlife. And so we have a program called Taking Action for Wildlife, where we go out to communities and provide that information to them and train their conservation commission and selectmen on how to use the wildlife action plan and how to incorporate that into their zoning ordinances or just proactively going out and protecting the most important areas in their towns.
How open do you see communities toward paying attention to what the wildlife action plan says? I mean, sometimes, you want to build the new business, you want to build a new business, and too bad for the rabbit.
Yeah, of course, there's always competing interests. Back in 2000, when we started down this wildlife action plan planning process, and our first one was developed in 2005, it took a little while for people to get up to speed with them. But now I feel like people are really familiar with wildlife action plans, really aware of what they are and what's in them. And they bring that to the town, and they use that as part of the picture. It's a tool in making those decisions.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that it's a resource that now, town decision makers are looking for factual information that they can base all their decisions on. And 20 years ago, there wasn't a plan like this that they could refer to. It was hard to pull that information together. But now there's a source. And that's the cool thing about it.
Absolutely.
So it started about 18 years ago,
correct,
Mike. So, yeah, so you're right, Chris. 20 years ago, we didn't have this tool.
And we're in the second version of it now. So the first version then was refined after 10 years. And so now we have an even better handle.
Do you want to jump in, Dave?
Yeah, I think another important part is not only how the Wildlife Action Plan informs land conservation at the statewide. We have a greater land protection capacity through the growth of regional land trusts, but also through management of habitats. So in addition to protecting, how are we managing? And we've lost farmlands and open space that were more common in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And those are some of the species that are now finding themselves in sort of rare, threatened, and endangered categories. So are we managing for early successional forests? Are we managing for brushlands, for some of the species that like former farmlands?
So if I could summarize, and I'm hearing a lot of the changes that you guys have seen over 20 years, more information, more data, maybe more of an interest in taking this data into account when it comes to land use and planning. On the other hand, it seems like more of the state's habitat being eaten up, fragmented landscapes, which makes it difficult for wildlife. So kind of a, I don't know, Rosemary, a tale of two cities? I know that's like really overused, but.
Yeah, I guess there's always a good side and bad side to everything, you know. I think what I wanted to say was that technology is now in everybody's hands, too, which is kind of cool because more people have cameras and more people can document things and more people are outside and can then say, look, I took a picture of this and send it to Mike and he can, you know, react to that. And so that's been kind of interesting, too.
That's another shift that has sort of enhanced our understanding and the churn. Things move much more quickly now, and so you can get the information faster. It must also be overwhelming for people, though, fish and game at times.
No, we love the input from the citizens. We have a wildlife sightings reporting website where, I mean, we have a relatively small staff, so we'd actually depend on citizens providing us information from reptiles and amphibians to birds to mammals. So we gather that information and we actually use that in the science and the information that we generate.
Well, it's interesting. I think it was you, Dave, talked about, you know, land being fragmented. I think, Chris, you talked about conservation groups and how there's more awareness, there's more involvement. Some of the Something Wild producers talked with environmental professionals about what some of the biggest shifts they've seen in terms of attitudes changing over the past 20 years. Here's a little bit from New Hampshire Audubon president Doug Bechtel on the changes he's seen in the last 20 years. Let's hear.
I think something that's changed in the last 20 years is the community of land trusts in New Hampshire has gotten a lot more sophisticated about land protection. It's not only for wildlife or for habitat or for forests, but it's for all the values that people in New Hampshire care about, things like working forests, working farmland, biodiversity. And I think something that's changed in the last 20 years is not only the amount of land, but the sophistication and the collaboration among land trusts across New Hampshire.
Okay, and again, that's New Hampshire Audubon President Doug Bechtel reflecting on some of the changes he's seen in terms of wildlife and habitat conservation over the past two decades that Something Wild has been on the air. Real quick to you, Dave, what do you think about that?
I think it's spot on. Decision makers, landowners, community officials, selectmen, conservation commissions have access to maps of their towns. They can then make those decisions about where they're protecting land and where the towns are going to grow for economic development.
Well, and as I said, the Something Wild team asked a couple environmental professionals around the state getting their reflections on the past two decades. Let's hear a little bit now from Christine Rhines. Many of you know her. She's the leader of New Hampshire's Moose Project. Let's hear from Christine Rhines.
So it would have to be how strong non-game conservation has become. There wasn't any such thing when I came to work 30 years ago, and it's become a big thing now. I mean, most people are on board with protecting non-game wildlife. And now we're focused on land mammals and amphibians and reptiles and insects. So that's huge. And in fact, plants. So, yeah, it's marvelous.
Again, that's Moose Project biologist Christine Rhines. So what do you think, Mike, just explain to our listeners this shift in sort of non-game, game species and the greater focus that Christine Rhines sees there.
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. State wildlife agencies were created essentially to protect game, wildlife, and sport fish. But over the years, the public recognized the need to protect the full diverse array of wildlife, the reptiles, the amphibians, and the birds. And but it took some time, and it wasn't until really 2000 when these state wildlife grants became available to states to do work. Prior to that, in our program, our non-game program consisted of one individual, John Cantor, and a part-time individual. So the state wildlife grants have allowed us to expand and work with partners to actually get work done on the ground for these species and learn a lot, actually know where some of these reptiles and amphibians are, whereas prior to that, we really had a minimal amount of information.
So before, fish and game was really about sport fishing and hunting. The other animals, critters, whatever you want to call them, that were involved in the habitat didn't get the attention and protection that they get now?
I think that's largely true. I think people were interested, but because of the funding, there wasn't a dedicated funding source associated with those non-game or that diversity of wildlife. The same could be said about the department in general. We do a lot more conservation education than we did historically, and even the law enforcement have expanded their duties to include talking to landowners and search and rescue, things that weren't historically part of the department.
Rosemary, how does that reflect a shifting culture here in New Hampshire, that shifting focus of New Hampshire Fish and Game?
Well, I guess it reflects that fewer people are hunting and maybe, I don't know about fishing, but there's a lot more bird watchers, I think. There's a lot more people feeding birds in their backyard. There's more people going out and taking pictures of reptiles and frogs and I guess that's just me, maybe, but
helping the reptile or the amphibians cross the road.
The crossing brigades. There's people out there on rainy nights in the spring helping amphibians and salamanders across the road.
Really?
Oh yeah, it's a big thing. I did a spot on that once
on something wild.
On something wild.
So
yeah.
Wait. So it's moving season, it's mating season. What's going on there, Rosemary?
Yeah,
I'll let you jump in too, Chris.
In the spring, on rainy nights, it's coming up very soon, any minute now. Well, probably not tomorrow, but wood frogs and spotted salamanders and peepers all move to their breeding pools, and they get together, they have a big party, and they reproduce. And so they tend to cross roads because roads are kind of in their way now. And so people go out and they help them across the road. So you put on your rain gear, you get your flashlight, and people know now where these places are because they're always the same place.
Oh, I see.
And
okay, it's not random.
No. Well, I mean, it's becoming more known because of technology and people doing it for over the last 20 years. So
in New York City, people go out to nightclubs and bars. And in New Hampshire, people go out with their raincoats
That's
and
right.
help frogs and turtles cross
yes.
the
yes.
road. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Chris, you wanted to jump in on that vernal migration?
Well,
can we call it that? I'm not sure.
There was an article in the news just the other day about the city of Keene actually deciding for a certain interval of time in the spring, they're going to close certain roads at certain hours because of the amount of mortality of amphibians using that spot as basically a place to migrate from where they overwinter to their breeding pools. And so, affecting and impacting every person in that local area.
What's been the reaction in Keene to that?
Well, you'd have to send your reporters out there to find out.
Wow. I wonder if some people are, irritated because
they're
going to have to take a longer way.
It's a story. You should check it out.
Very interesting. Yeah. This, again, reflects the shifting culture that you all have talked about. Wildlife viewing is more of a big deal.
Can you imagine road closures for amphibians in a city in the state in 1940, 1950, 1980?
No. No. What about that changing culture, Mike? The idea that your agency's mission has expanded to become more of a conservation mission in recent years.
Yeah, I think it represents the public's interest in wildlife and their passion for wildlife and the full array of wildlife. And people are interested in wildlife for different reasons, and they're all great, whether you're in the woods hunting or fishing or whether you're just bird watching or going down to the local pond with your dad or grandpa, everybody relates, but everybody has a connection to wildlife, and so I think it's really important, and it's a important thing to be involved in the future.
And this has been, I'm not going to push you too much on this now because we've done whole shows on this with the Fish and Game commissioner, but it's the idea that even though your agency now is more fishing and hunting, but also habitat management, the funding stream is still largely from hunting and fishing licenses, right?
That is correct. And so there are a couple new initiatives coming forward that we're really excited about, but the non-game program has its own sources of funding. We rely heavily on non-game donations, which we're very thankful for, as well as the Moose Plate and the state wildlife grants at the federal level.
Can you also talk about that, Dave, please? The idea that, you know, 20 years ago, certainly 40 or 50 years ago, New Hampshire was more of a hunting and fishing state. And today it's, you know, kind of about bird watching and wildlife viewing and hunting.
I don't think a decrease in fishing and hunting licenses is a good thing. I think it actually reflects people who have access to nature but may not have the same direct experience. When I go to schools and I talk to students, it's interesting to see the Carhartt kids, I call them, or the Mossy Camo kids, who absolutely know tremendous amount about hunting and fishing and forests. And they can identify, you know, all kinds of trees. And they spent their life often with a parent mentor or a grandparent mentor. And so that handing down of wisdom that takes place while spending time outside hunting and fishing is a really, really important part of enculturation into wildlife. And so I don't view, you know, a decrease in sales of hunting and fishing licenses as anything other than a loss of direct experience with nature. I think it's really important to give our kids and grandkids that opportunity.
So you talked earlier about greater nature literacy these days, but now it sounds like you're saying, no, not so much.
Well, I worry about it. It's something to keep our eye on. It's part of the barometer of New Hampshire. If you're looking at what's going on, sales of hunting and fishing licenses is an important indicator of how connected people are to the management of the habitats where we live. And increasingly in a suburban setting in southern New Hampshire, or exurban, just out of rural, you know, not rural areas. And so that's something I keep an eye on. The other thing I want to mention is, I apologize for this term. You used it earlier, charismatic megafauna. You can always talk about deer, bears, moose, loons, bobcats, fishers. Every weekend,
these are big, attractive animals that people love to watch.
Every weekend, there's bobcat postings on Facebook. It's like the bobcat of the weekend. But you don't hear as much about maybe hognose snakes or golden wing warblers or Blanding's turtles or spotted turtles or some of the species that are not so well known. And some of those are actually species that require young forests and early successional habitat that are actually aging out. Our forests are 20 years older, 20 years later. That seems obvious. They're also 20 to 30 feet taller. And the habitat opportunities are changing if we don't manage those landscapes to accommodate a full suite of species.
All right. We will talk more about that in a moment. And start taking your questions and comments. So keep the emails coming, exchange@nhpr.org. And Mike Marchand, I know you have to go. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That's Mike Marchand, Program Supervisor of New Hampshire Fish and Game Department's Non-Game and Endangered Wildlife Program. More on the 20th anniversary of Something Wild in a moment, and what we've learned over those 20 years about land conservation, habitat, the natural world here in New Hampshire. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Everyone could do with a bit of Irish luck now and again, which is why you should support NHPR today. When you do, you'll get not one, but two chances to win a trip to Dublin, Ireland, courtesy of Milne Travel American Express. That's two chances to see the brilliant Cliffs of Moher, stroll through St. Stephen's Green, or drink in some knowledge at the Old Jameson Distillery. The lucky winner will be picked on St. Paddy's Day, but you can increase your odds now with your gift today at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're celebrating 20 years of Something Wild on NHPR by looking back at the many changes in the great outdoors over that time. So let's hear from you. What have you noticed in New Hampshire in terms of our natural world? Whether it's more eagles or fewer moose or landscapes that you love or the way you see people approaching nature. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. With me in studio, three Something Wild hosts, past and present. Rosemary Conroy, she was one of the first hosts of the show while she was at the Forest Society. Today, Rosemary is a contemporary wildlife artist living in Ware. And the current hosts, Dave Anderson with the Forest Society, and Chris Martin with New Hampshire Audubon are with us in studio. One more time, let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 6477. So here's a Facebook comment that came in from Lynn, who says, I really enjoy the Something Wild series. I've noticed this winter that I've had a lot more birds of prey around my yard. I've had more hawks than usual and had a very big bird that looked like an osprey swoop down and pick up a dead animal on the road in front of my house. Wish I could have snapped a picture. Lynn, thank you. And Chris, that's for you.
Well, for Lynn, the bird she saw this winter that looked like an osprey that swooped down and picked up an animal. Since ospreys are all in the tropics during the winter months and have a 3,000-mile migration to get back to New Hampshire, which they're doing right now, actually.
Did anybody tell them about the storm that's coming in?
No, but yeah, well, they're not here yet, fortunately. But the point is, what we do have are bald eagles, which don't always have white heads and tails. For 3 years of their lives, they're a real mishmash of browns and whites and speckles and all kinds of patterns, variegated
patterns.
I see.
So they're large birds of prey,
and
but they don't look like eagles.
And in the winter, they focus on carrion, on dead items. They're not, you know, obviously, they can't get as many fish in the winter. So they focus on dead things, and that brings them to the roadside a lot of times, which is actually a hazard. So she probably saw, if it was that big, she probably saw an immature bald eagle.
A hazard for the bird, but a handy cleanup service for us, right?
Indeed, indeed.
You know, I want to ask all three of you about a couple themes that have come up again and again over the 20 years that Something Wild has been on the air. And as we talk about some of these bigger themes, if you want to mention episodes that you did that illustrate the point, please feel free. Over the 20 years, I have noticed, I'd love to hear from all of you on this, that the public loves to learn about the struggles and successes of certain New Hampshire animals and birds. I'm thinking of the bobcat hunting debate. I'm thinking of debates over trapping. I'm thinking of the plights of the moose and the loon, the revival of the eagle and the peregrine falcon. What do you think, Rosemary? You first. What is it about these stories that really captures people's interest?
Well, I think, I mean, we all can relate to animals because we are animals. So, I mean, that's a really strong connection that we all have. But again, to go back to social media, I mean, when people... There's Eric Aldrich in Hancock is posting pictures of bobcats that he's catching on his cameras all the time. And so then people post it and then repost it. And so now everybody knows that there's bobcats around. And then people start talking about bobcats and then it becomes a popular subject. And so people get, you know, irate if something starts happening to bobcats, you know, like they want to trap them again. So people got all riled up by that. So I think it's just things are becoming more familiar, even though you're not seeing them directly. There's this sharing of information that's going on that's just, it's amazing. I mean, it's crazy. We didn't have this 20 years ago. People weren't out in the woods with cameras all the time or, you know, with phones. People didn't have cameras on their phones 20 years ago. Remember that?
No.
It's hard to remember. But yeah, it's such a everybody has access to things now that we didn't have 20 years ago. So it's really fascinating. I mean,
so it's easier to care.
Yes, I think so, because it becomes it's in your, you know, you get this information sent to you all the time. I mean, every time you turn on Facebook, there's something like that.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, I think the level of discussion has been raised by some of this technology. I mean, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, if someone would, they would claim that they might have seen a golden eagle in the state. And, you know, there would be obvious skepticism from wildlife authorities on that, including myself, because they're extremely rare. But now people are actually producing photographs that you can look at and analyze. It's not a he said, she said sort of discussion. It's actually, well, here it is. You know, what do you think?
Right.
And that happens all the time. People send stuff like that in.
So they say, you know, hey, Mr. Yeah. Smarty Pants Audubon, I did see a golden
and,
eagle.
Yes, and in fact, there,
here's
are,
the picture.
There are some golden eagles in the state this time of year, especially in the winter.
What do you think, Dave, these stories about, you know, bears or bobcats or loons or eagles. I mean, people just, these have been some of our most popular shows on The Exchange.
Sure, and they're all specialists. They all have really tight habitat requirements. I want to throw in a word for the generalists, the things that are in our backyards. What about squirrels? I don't see a lot of social media postings about the gray squirrels robbing people's bird feeders. It happens every single day. Deer, raccoons, foxes, the things that live in our backyards. So we get on a little bit of a slippery slope when we're incredibly fascinated by these specialist species. And, you know, we maybe don't appreciate, you know, the things that are more common and are more adapted across a wider, you know, wider habitat. We didn't have some of the birds that we have today. Pileated woodpeckers did not exist in the young forests of the 1950s and 60s, and now people take them for granted. It was a rare bird sighting when the first pileated woodpecker showed up in the late 1950s. Things like bluebirds coming back. I saw bluebirds yesterday hopping around with some robins in a little patch of open grass surrounded by snow. And it's like, wow, you know, it's spring.
What are you
coming.
Doing here?
Yeah. Like, oh, did you see the weather forecast? You know?
Well, I'm glad you're making this point because I wanted to ask all of you, you know, these animals, they're beautiful. You can share pictures and so forth. You can validate your claim that you saw a certain type of bird. But maybe to you first, Dave, but I want to hear from everybody. These animals also tell us something about the natural world. And I think that's what you're getting at, you know. If the eagle is thriving, maybe that says that we're doing something right. Or the peregrine falcon, which was struggling because of the use of chemicals. If moose are struggling, it's because climate change is a problem. So just what do these animals open up for us in terms of telling us a story about the landscape that, you know, we live in?
So things that we're doing right, protecting habitats, linking conservation lands and protecting land that's critical wildlife corridors or connecting areas so wildlife can move from one block to another. That becomes even more important when we talk about resiliency, you know, in a world of climate change. Also getting chemicals out of the environment. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, we banned DDT. Chris knows, I worked with ospreys when I was in college, and eggshells were still thinning in birds that were getting a load of DDT in their wintering grounds. And as these birds have come back, ospreys, eagles, peregrines, it reflects that some of these chemicals are now out of the environment. MTBE from gasoline is another one we worry about, groundwater. Wetlands, really, really important species. So turning our attention from charismatic moose and loons and bears to the more generalists and how are they doing across the state. I think that's important.
Well, since you mentioned peregrine falcons, that's a big success story of habitat restoration, working against chemicals and their impact on the environment. We've got a little bit of a clip I want to play here. This is Chris and Dave actually going to Rumney Cliffs to observe peregrine falcons, which, as you all mentioned, have rebounded since the 40s and 50s when they struggled because of the use of DDT. Let's hear.
Peregrine,
cool. Look at this, coming in.
That's a male yelling at the raven.
Keep watching. She's stooping it right now. She's right into the woods there. Here she comes.
Comes the raven.
They're ganging up on it.
Look, they're right overhead.
Okay, so, and speaking of someone who spent most of her career in radio, really nice audio there.
Thank you.
Chris.
Yeah, thanks to Ross Boyd, our producer.
Yeah.
We hiked up an icy slope to get to the base of Rattlesnake Cliffs in Rumney, and we were literally perched. If we had gone any higher, we would have needed ropes, and Chris brought us there. It was an amazing day.
Well, it was like a giant bird video game, but it was actually happening. And so, you know, with our feet deep in the snow, it was great.
A bird video game.
Yeah, it was like this classic battle between these two species for territory and a nest site. And the ravens are trying to stay out of the way of the falcons, and the falcons are dive bombing it. It was incredible.
Okay, so speaking of games, we were talking about earlier about how, you know, it's easy to get latched onto the bear because they're so cute and the moose because they're so big and unusual. But Rosemary, one of the things that the show has tried to do is get people interested in these less charismatic animals. And I want to play a little clip from when you were the host. You and co-host Ian McLeod played Name That Amphibian. And again, amphibians, you know, they're not as adorable and huggable as, you know, bears. I'm not suggesting anybody hug bears, by the way, but you know what I'm talking about. Let's hear a little bit of that. And then I do want to ask you about, you know, elevating the profile of these less adorable animals. So this is Rosemary and Ian from an early episode of Something Wild playing Name That Amphibian.
Which of you can best recreate the sound of American toads trilling during their annual spring courtship? Rosemary? Is that your final toad call?
Yes, it is.
Ian?
I can do better than that. How about that?
Now let's play the actual toad sound. I think it's pretty clear Ian does a better toad.
Oh, that's not fair. I can do a really good green frog.
Oh, come on, let's
listen,
hear it.
Listen, listen.
Okay, it's obviously a tie.
Oh, that's all come on, that's nothing. Can you do a bullfrog?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Something wild.
Jug-a-room,
this has been
listen, jug-a-room.
Would you like another opportunity to make that sound, Miss Mary?
Have you improved?
I still cannot do a toad. It's really hard.
So I so appreciate that about Something Wild. And that's continued since the early days when you were on.
Yes.
You're not just sitting there saying, everybody needs to protect animals. You're making it fun. You're making it interesting. And that's a great example. But talk, Rosemary, please, a little bit about, you know, efforts through your current work, your current art, or on Something Wild to just raise the profile of these, you know, sort of slimy things that aren't that cute.
Well, I mean, I'll talk about my art, sure. I did a series recently, and I tried to focus on things that I didn't want to see disappear. And so I did a series. I included Luna moths and Blanding's turtles and toads and damselflies. And people were so excited by them.
Really?
And I sold them all. So it was pretty cool that there are people out there who are excited to see those things and want to hang them on their walls. So even though I do paint a lot of bears and moose and things like that, there is an audience for it. And I think there's just people in New Hampshire have that connection. And I think it's because of us. Something Wild has done such a good job over the years of keeping those ideas out there and reminding people to go outside or to even just look outside or look up from your laptop for a moment and appreciate it.
Well, and moths are, you know, I don't know, not the most, like, if I see a butterfly, I'm excited. If I see a moth, I kind of think, ick.
Yeah. But you haven't seen a Luna moth.
Well, maybe not.
Cecropia moth.
Yeah, there's so many beautiful moths, Laura. We have to go out.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to get Laura outside.
At night.
So talk a little bit about that, too, what Rosemary mentioned, Chris. The idea that, you know, enhancing the profile of these less attractive, with all apologies to the moth, enhances our understanding of our impact on the natural world, on our connection to it.
Well, I think one of the main overarching themes that we've tried to go with in Something Wild for all this time has been to give people better insights into how nature works. Because when you understand what's going on, you understand the life cycle, you understand the risks that these animals face every day and conquer every day, you can appreciate them more. And so when we interview experts and things like that, I think the idea is to give people more of an insider's view of nature as biologists understand it. And there's nothing better than that, to give people that empathy, that feeling of, oh, you know, I didn't realize. And I get that kind of response a lot of times. I didn't know that. I sure am glad you did that show.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Dave, you want to jump in on that too?
Yeah, you know, so everybody was birding and looking for birds and keeping a life list. And I've noticed this trend over the last 10, 15 years of people going out looking for odonates, which are dragonflies and damselflies and little aquatic ephemerals that, you know, hatch out in the spring. So people are broadening their horizons beyond birds to actually collecting sightings of insects and, you know, catching them in nets and releasing them. I would say we definitely empathize with animals. I know, Rosemary, at one point you were at risk of being like the chicken lady because you were painting chickens and roosters, and I raised chickens at home. We relate to our dogs and our cats and our chickens.
Exactly.
That's biophilia. We love nature. We have an innate need. Ecologist E.O. Wilson wrote a book, The Biophilia Hypothesis, about that, just that. So there's actually a spiritual need for nature in our lives. People also need an antidote to hard news. And, you know, we connect with nature, and that does wonderful things for our stress levels, our cortisol, nature as the medicine cabinet. I don't want to get on that soapbox, but the soapbox I will get on is, what about trees, man? What about ferns? What about soil mycorrhizae and, you know, how forests provide habitat for animals?
Well, that's an important point that we haven't talked that much about. Earlier on, we talked about land conservation and people starting to understand that this habitat does make a difference, not just for this particular animal, which is cute or not cute, but it might help prevent flooding, which will help my basement not get flooded, or it might help keep the air quality clean. So we're starting to make those connections. But I appreciate you saying that, Dave, because, you know, trees are beautiful, obviously, But it's not the same as seeing a Rosemary Conroy painting of a beautiful bear.
Right, but we live in the second most forested state by land area in the nation. We're 84% forests. And as I like to mess around with Chris, as he walks around with an eagle on his arm and all the kids flock to him, and all I've got is a little white pine in a coffee cup that's 3 inches tall. It's making its own food. Its stomates are opening. It's providing sticks when it's mature for eagles to build their nests. And I'm pretty sure eagles hunt from trees along the shores of lakes. So this is my tree guy inferiority.
Well, I'll remind you, there is a state big tree list for people who want to document the biggest trees of all species,
right,
all
thinking,
around the
we've
state.
We've been thinking about setting up, like, you know, you have that peregrine cam in Manchester. We're going to set up a tree cam.
Pine cam.
Yeah, a pine cam.
But people don't want to give that away because then everybody will go visit it and somebody might damage it, right? Do you want to keep that a little bit secret?
Oh, the big trees?
Yeah.
No, it's kind of a competition. So they're looking for county champions and state champions and national champions.
Well, talking about, you know, getting kids out in nature, educating people, but also not wanting to disturb what is there. You guys spoke a while back. Actually, I'm not sure who was hosting at this point in time. I apologize. But you spoke with the famous New Hampshire naturalist, writer, painter David Carroll, known as the Turtle Guy in New Hampshire. This is an excerpt from an interview he did with you, Dave, actually. And he talks about this sort of tricky balance between getting out in nature and protecting nature. Maybe we don't all need to be stomping around. Let's hear from the Turtle Guy, David Carroll.
I can't really get on the last child in the woods kind of bandwagon. First of all, I don't see the natural world as a cure for human dissatisfactions or disappointments. It is such a much more sacred thing than that. Oh, you know, I gave a lot of talks in schools, and I show them slides of the places I go, you know, and I talk about vernal pools. And I just stopped and I said, you know, I would love to take you, or I'd love to have you see a place like this. But I said, there are 55 of you. I said, that's 110 booted feet. The landscape can't bear that. It just can't. It's just impossible.
Again, that's David Carroll, known as the Turtle Guy in New Hampshire. This is an excerpt from an interview that Dave Anderson did on NHPR's Something Wild. And this hour in the Exchange, we're celebrating 20 years of Something Wild on NHPR by looking back at how habitat management, wildlife conservation, and just our understanding of how the natural world works has changed over that time. And we're learning a lot. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Now, coming up, we're just going to look back at the program itself and some of the best memories over the past two decades. We'll play some more fun clips too. So stay with us for that. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy, and that music you hear is the original Something Wild theme, an NHPR segment that began 20 years ago and continues today, helping us understand New Hampshire's natural world. This hour, we're celebrating 20 years of Something Wild by looking back at what we've learned and the many changes over that time. As always, let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Three Something Wild hosts are with me in studio, past and present, Rosemary Conroy, Chris Martin, and Dave Anderson. And, you know, obviously you all came to hosting Something Wild, knowing something about the natural world and how it works. But I just wonder what you yourself learned over that time. I'm guessing your time as host was full of sort of, wow, I didn't know that, or themes that kept coming up and you thought, wow, now I do know that. Rosemary, what What did you learn over your time hosting Something Wild? How long did you host it, by the way?
I did it for 10 plus years.
Wow, it's a long time.
Yeah, we started back in 1998, which is obviously. And I just want to give a shout out to Dick Ober and Mark Hanley, because they were the two who came up with the idea of having Something Wild. And so we should all be grateful to them. And I guess what I learned is that people love to tell their stories, because that's where I got so many of my ideas for episodes, where somebody would come up to me and say, you know what I've always wanted to know is, or I had this experience with, and so it would be like, oh, that's great, because if you have that question or experience, probably other people do, and that's a good way, that's a good segue into an episode. So that's how I got many of my ideas.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, I didn't come into this as a nature educator. I came into this as a wildlife biologist. And to be honest, completely honest, I was hesitant to get behind a microphone and do this stuff.
What?
Yes. But and I totally appreciate folks like Scott Fitzpatrick, who also was a host for a while for New Hampshire Audubon, and Ian McLeod and yourself, Rosemary, for doing this, and Dave. But communicating about nature is not always as easy as Dave makes it seem. He's incredible at this. You have to know your facts. You have to make sure that you're telling people the real thing and not another story about how things doesn't really work. So it's a lot of work. It's a challenge, and I've learned a lot just about communicating. Yeah. So I love it.
Past episodes, by the way, if people are thinking, Something Wild, I never catch that. You know, I'm always busy on Friday mornings. They're available as a podcast, so you don't have to miss a single show. And be sure to check out the Exchange website today for pictures and excerpts from favorite Something Wild episodes. Also, all of you have mentioned like what you learn and the ability to communicate. Our producer, Jessica Hunt, put a list of Something Wild vocabulary words. You can even quiz your nature literacy. I have to say, I looked at it this morning. I thought I knew a fair bit about nature. I don't know, at least half, probably two-thirds of the words there. So what have you learned, Dave, doing this show for as long as you have?
Well, I'm with Chris. I mean, learning about communication, so it's not enough to be informative. You should be entertaining, and it should be fun. And if we're having fun, I think people can hear that. One of the things that I really liked was that we developed a little segment called New Hampshire's Wild Neighborhoods, which showcased natural communities, different types of like a talus woodland community or an alpine zone or a sand dune. So not focusing on a species, but a whole suite of species and the habitat that they require. And then the other thing that I really am proud of is those first bitten stories, people talking about the origin.
First bitten.
When were you first bitten by the nature bug?
The nature
bug.
Yeah,
when I first heard that title, I was like, ooh, I don't know if that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. It's your first love. When did you catch that nature bug? And so we have a couple of little segments we do where we profile people's stories of how they came to work in natural resources. So if we have an ologist in here with us, we'll ask them to tell us about their first memories of connecting with nature. And those are great stories. Those are heart stories, not head stories.
So that list again, 20 words for 20 years that Jessica put together, is impressive to test your nature literacy. And you use one of the words right there. I don't even know what an ologist is
that? Oh, no, I just threw that out, like biologist, ichthyologist, ornithologist.
Oh, I see.
That's
gotcha.
Shorthand for
someone who studies.
An expert, yeah.
Don't forget dendrologist.
Oh, dendrologist, thank you.
Thank you.
A couple emails are coming in, and Barb in Goffstown says, I've been feeding birds for over 20 years, and my winter feeders were predominantly visited by purple finches, New Hampshire state bird, and house finches. I never see these anymore, Barbara says. In fact, I had a solitary house finch at a feeder a week ago and was shocked to see it, realizing how long it had been since I'd seen one. Barb says, what happened to the finches?
Well, we have a program at New Hampshire Audubon called the Backyard Winter Bird Survey, and we've been doing that for well over 20 years. And the fact is that bird populations change over time. And some species become more common, some species become less common as the habitat around them changes. And there are other species that erupt. There's a word, it's not even on the list, that they erupt from elsewhere in North America, show up in one winter in the state in big numbers, and the next winter they're gone. The house finches have been subject to an eye disease, which has dropped their numbers down a little bit. Purple finches are one of those eruptive species that move in the winter from Canada to the U.S. with great ease. And so this was a pretty good year for purple finches this year.
Why does that happen? You know, all of a sudden a certain species erupts.
Well, that's a strategy for surviving the winter when a food resource on a tree, like a spruce tree or balsam fir, varies from year to year. Because the cone crops are variable. There's a word for that too, right?
Yes, masting.
Masting, okay. So so these bird populations follow the abundance of the cone crop around because that's their food supply in the winter.
So you're saying the trees are actually setting the stage for wildlife habitat?
No, I was saying the birds move around.
I'm saying that the tree.
The tree guy is still trying to get a little bit more respect
here's
for the
thing
the trees.
About Barb from Goffstown's question is she's feeding birds. I feed birds. It's different all the time. That's what makes it interesting. I mean, at my house this year, I was watching and waiting and keeping lists of, you know, what's out there. We had a junco year this year. We were just loaded with juncos. And it took a while, but only recently we've got our goldfinches back. And so I like seeing them and comparing them with years past. So citizen science, backyard bird feeder people providing information to Audubon Society.
Two quick points. One is if you plant trees, you're feeding birds. Okay, you don't have to put seed out to feed birds. Plant trees in your yard and you'll be feeding birds.
And you won't have to worry about squirrels and bears.
Right, right. And the second thing is even a dead animal on the side of the road is a bird feeder because raptors will eat that stuff. And your birds are food for other birds as well.
Mm-hmm. Rosemary, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that was at least three spots that we did. Eruptive species, citizen science, forests, habitat, et cetera.
And episodes that just people loved, that people wanted to know about. You kept getting questions probably from people like Barb. Why am I seeing this year? Why don't I see that this year?
Perfect example.
So not to be a total downer, but how often did you have to respond, Rosemary, climate change is the reason that we're not seeing as many of X, Y, or Z?
Well, I was, you know, it was 20 years ago when I started, so climate change wasn't as big a thing. It was just starting to come. It was something that people were starting to suspect, you know, was having an impact. So I probably got away with not having to say climate change as often as probably Dave and Chris do, for better or for worse.
And in one of your recent shows, though, your painting shows, you pay homage to animals that are struggling because of climate change.
Yeah, I did a show about, I called it Never Can Say Goodbye. It was just sort of about animals I never want to say goodbye to. And so it was about things that are on the edge or I'd like to raise awareness about. And so it was animals from all around the world, but including many homegrown New Hampshire animals, too.
Well, and Dave and Chris, you know, again, Something Wild is informative and fun and playful, and that's what people love about it. But, Dave, how often do you find yourself these days saying, it might be climate change, that's why the moose looks so skinny, or that's why the bird is back early?
Well, we like watching trends in our backyards and then trying to extrapolate or what we're seeing connected to the bigger picture, and, of course, they are storm events. Superstorm, Hurricane Sandy, and the things that have happened that have changed the landscape have actually focused attention on resiliency. So there's another one of those $10 words for our list. But how is our landscape going to accommodate changes, and including these extreme storm events? And will wildlife and forests be able to respond?
Do you want to jump in, Chris?
Yeah, because wildlife is not one thing that has one set of requirements. There's such a broad diversity of animals and plants out there that although we might be worried about the loss of a certain species, there are other species that are ready to jump in. If our climate here in New Hampshire warms 10 or 15 degrees, there are elements of nature that will take those spots. It might mean we lose our sugar maple production in the state, and that would be a tragedy. But our oak forests will also be beautiful. I'm trying to see the grain of goodness in this, but we don't want to see it change. But climate change is part of nature.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Rosemary, do you want to jump back in on that?
Well, I was going to add to that, like, people are now seeing cardinals above the notch. I mean, that's something that we didn't have 20 years ago.
Wow.
Or even 10 years ago. So that's probably an indicator of climate change, but it's... people are happy to see cardinals. So,
I see cardinals in my yard all the time, but I obviously don't live above the notch. So.
Well, they're a relatively new species. We didn't have cardinals here 20, 30 years ago.
Really?
They've moved in from further south, so bonus.
And similarly, Bicknell's thrush, which live in alpine zones of the White Mountains, and an endemic species to New Hampshire, Chris?
Well, it's the ones that are on the fringe of their habitat, like Bicknell's thrush, that don't have really an option to move anyplace. Those are the ones that are most affected by climate changes.
Well, you learn something new every day. I did not know that about cardinals. And by the way, I love seeing them. I mean, in a dreary winter landscape when the snow is kind of ugly and everything looks brown, it's great to see a cardinal. Well, last question for all of you. You know, Rosemary, you first. You were an original host, as I said. What was the goal back then that you hoped to accomplish? And do you think you accomplished it?
Well, I really wanted it to be a celebration and a bit of uplifting information, news, entertainment for people. You know, I had only 2 minutes back in the day, so I had to jam a lot in there, but I really wanted
two
it to...
2 minutes?
Yes. And I'm just, yeah, so I think we did a good job doing that. I'm really impressed with what Dave and Chris have been able to accomplish here, just taking it and made it even better, and I'm just, like, so proud that the show is continuing and... It warms my heart. So
yeah.
I really appreciate what you guys have done with the show. And I guess we all need to celebrate the beautiful place that we have here in New Hampshire, because that's one of the things that makes New Hampshire special, is that we have wildlife and wildness and trees and plants and all these things out our doors. And not everybody has that in the world. So I think it's worthy of celebration over and over again.
What do you think, Dave?
I think back, one of my favorite ever was sitting down with Ben Killam and having him tell a bear story, and he personifies a bear. He looks like a bear. Chris told me his favorite was a woodcock story we did, which was about going out with my kids and waiting for woodcocks to do their sky dance. So touching people's hearts and bringing people and their connections to nature in, that's always a goal.
Well, if you want to go to our website, we've got some of those excerpts that you mentioned there. It's NHPR Exchange, and you can also check out the podcast of Something Wild. We've got that quiz, 20 words for 20 years that Something Wild has used. Also, I also want to close out with just some emails that came in real quick. Eric says he loves Something Wild and its hosts. Grace also says, two fabulous shows that focus on New Hampshire, meaning The Exchange and Something Wild. Thank you, Grace. She says, you both educate, entertain, and enrich us. So, Grace, thank you for that. And happy birthday, Something Wild.
Wow.
And thank you. And thank you guys for being here today. I really appreciate it. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.